From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I'm Jim Nicola. I'm the Artistic Director of New York Theatre Workshop, and I'm here to talk about some of the issues that are around the production of My Name is Rachel Corrie.
The play I co-edited, My Name is Rachel Corrie, has been cancelled, postponed indefinitely in New York, and I'm really disappointed and shocked because the reasons given for it were political reasons, the election of Hamas in the Palestinian elections and the ill health of Ariel Sharon, and I'm confused that something like this could be happening in the US.
My Name is Rachel Corrie, a play based on the words of the American peace activist crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer in Gaza 3 years ago. The play is causing controversy in New York now, after the theater that was scheduled to run it indefinitely postponed the production. We'll speak with the two top directors of the New York Theater Workshop and the editor of the play. She's in London. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has indicated U.S. troops are likely to stay in Iraq until at least 2009. Speaking at a White House press conference Tuesday, his second this year, Bush said whether U.S. troops are withdrawn from Iraq will be up to future U.S. presidents and Iraqi governments to decide. Bush also defended the job performance of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld amid growing calls for his resignation. But Bush left open the possibility for future changes, saying, quote, "I'm not going to announce it right now." At the United Nations, a top diplomat is warning international efforts are failing to quell increasing violence in Sudan's south and western Darfur region. This is special representative to the Sudan, Yang Prank.
The Jamena ceasefire agreement is violated day after day. Both parties know that these violations will be noted down, but neither discussed nor addressed, let alone sanctioned. The ceasefire does not function. The Joint Committee does not meet. The sanctions foreseen with the establishment of the Security Council Panel of Experts exist only in theory.
Jan Pronk, the UN Special Representative to the Sudan. In Spain, the Basque separatist group ETA has announced a ceasefire to begin this week. A Basque media report said the ceasefire is to be permanent. The ceasefire would bring an end to nearly four decades of violent struggle since 1968. In Chile, a judge has issued arrest warrants for 13 former army officials accused of executing political opponents during the first months of the rule of General Augusto Pinochet. Over 75 dissidents were killed in the weeks immediately after the coup in an operation known as the Caravan of Death. A dozen other former officers have already been charged for taking part in that operation. One of the new suspects, Carlos Minolete Arriagada, currently lives in the United States. In Ecuador, a state of emergency has been declared in five provinces that have been hotbeds of protests against trade talks with the U.S. Thousands of indigenous Ecuadorians have taken part in blockades and protests that have shut down commercial activity in several parts of the country. Under the new emergency measures, public gatherings will be barred and curfews will be imposed. Ecuadorian officials will be in Washington for trade talks Thursday. In an interview with the Latin American television network Telesur, protest leader Luis Majas said, quote, "We want the government to act with prudence. What's more important, selling our country or holding on to our sovereignty?" he asked. In Israel, Baruch Marzel, a parliamentary candidate in the upcoming elections, has called for the assassination of well-known Israeli peace activist Uri Avneri. Marzel, who leads the National Jewish Front, said Israeli defense forces should target Uri Avneri, who leads the peace group Gush Shalom. Marzel's comments came after Avneri compared a Palestinian group's assassination of the former Israeli cabinet minister to Israel's policy of killing militant Palestinian leaders. Back in the United States, a U.S. soldier has been found guilty of using his dog to abuse detainees at Abu Ghraib. Sergeant Michael Smith was convicted on six counts, including maltreating detainees, dereliction of duty, and assault. He's the 10th soldier to be convicted in the Abu Ghraib torture scandal. Smith's defense argued he was only following orders, and his alleged use of the dog was in line with why his superiors ordered the use of dogs at Abu Ghraib. NBC News has revealed a top government official under Saddam Hussein acted as a paid informant to the CIA before the U.S. invaded Iraq. According to intelligence sources, former Iraqi Foreign Minister Naji Sabri gave information that contradicted two of the main stated reasons for going to war. Sabri said Saddam Hussein possessed no active biological or nuclear weapons programs. He also reportedly claimed Iraq had a cache of chemical weapons, an assertion that turned out to be false. Sabri was reportedly paid more than $100,000 for his information, which was delivered through a third party. In other news, the New York Times is reporting a Pentagon inquiry has cleared military contractor the Lincoln Group of wrongdoing over its planting of pro-U.S. military stories in Iraq newspapers. The inquiry was ordered after Lincoln Group's activities were disclosed last November. Pentagon officials said the company remains under contract and will continue its activities unless the military revises its policies. The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration has funneled millions of dollars in federal grant money to conservative social groups that support its social policies. Using faith-based programs and other government programs, the Bush administration has steered at least $157 million to groups that support the president's views on issues such as abortion and gay marriage. According to the Post, most of the funding came through government programs enacted after the Bush administration took office. In scores of cases, small anti-abortion centers have received federal funding that doubled or tripled their operating budgets. Democratic Congressmember Chet Edwards of Texas called the grant funding one of the largest patronage programs in American history. In Virginia Tuesday, the FBI was handed further embarrassment at the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. The supervisor of the agency's International Terrorism Division testified he had not read a memo delivered in August 2001 that recommended an investigation of Moussaoui as a possible hijacker. The testimony of Michael Rowlands, now retired, came after Monday's testimony from FBI agent Greg Samet that he spent 4 weeks trying to convince his superiors Moussaoui posed a security risk. According to Samet, FBI officials ignored his repeated warnings. And in Illinois, Tammy Duckworth is holding on to a slim lead in a widely watched Democratic primary in the state's 6th district. Duckworth is a former helicopter pilot who lost both her legs in Iraq. She's leading with 43% of the vote. Tammy Duckworth is one of a number of anti-war Iraq veterans making a run for Congress this year. And those are some of the headlines. In a minute, we're going to discuss the controversy around the play. My name is Rachel Corey. But first, we return to President Bush's news conference. Veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas asked President Bush what some analysts call the most direct questioning he's ever received on his reasons for invading Iraq.
I'd like to ask you, Mr. President, your decision to invade Iraq has caused the deaths of thousands of Americans and Iraqis, wounds of Americans and Iraqis for a lifetime. Every reason given, publicly at least, has turned out not to be true. My question is, why did you really want to go to war from the moment you stepped into the White House, from your cabinet, former cabinet officers, intelligence people, and so forth? What was your real reason? You have said it wasn't oil, quest for oil. It hasn't been Israel or anything else. What was it?
I think your premise, and all due respect to your question and to you as a lifelong journalist, is that, you know, I didn't want war. To assume I wanted war is just flat wrong, Helen, in all due respect. No, hold on for a second, please. Excuse me. No president wants war. Everything you may have heard is that, but it's just simply not true. My attitude about the defense of this country changed on September the 11th. When we got attacked, I vowed then and there to use every asset at my disposal to protect the American people. Our foreign policy changed on that day, Helen. You know, we used to think we were secure because of oceans and previous diplomacy, but we realized on September 11, 2001, that killers could destroy innocent life. And I'm never going to forget it. And I'm never going to forget the vow I made to the American people that we will do everything in our power to protect our people. Part of that meant to make sure that we didn't allow people to provide safe haven to an enemy, and that's why I went into Iraq. Hold on for a second. excuse me for a second, please. Excuse me for a second. They did. The Taliban provided safe haven for al-Qaeda. That's where al-Qaeda trained and... Helen, excuse me. Afghanistan provided safe haven for al-Qaeda. That's where they trained. That's where they plotted. That's where they planned the attacks that killed thousands of innocent Americans. I also saw a threat in Iraq. I was hoping to solve this problem diplomatically. That's why I went to the Security Council. That's why it was important to pass 1441, which was unanimously passed. And the world said, disarm, disclose, or face serious consequences. And therefore, we worked with the world. We worked to make sure that Saddam Hussein heard the message of the world. And when he chose to deny inspectors, when he chose not to disclose, then I had the difficult decision to make to remove him, and we did, and the world is safer for it.
That was President Bush answering Helen Thomas at the White House on Tuesday. Commonly referred to as the First Lady of the Press, Helen Thomas is the most senior member of the White House Press Corps. She has served as a White House correspondent for some 57 years and has covered every president since John F. Kennedy. It was the first time President Bush has called on Helen Thomas in 3 years. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the controversy over the play My Name is Rachel Corrie, which is based on the words of the late U.S. peace activist. 3 years ago this month, Rachel Corrie died at the age of 23 after she was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer in Gaza. At the time, Rachel was attempting to block the demolition of a home of a Palestinian doctor in the Gaza town of Rafah. The play opened last year in London to rave reviews and sold out audiences. It was scheduled to come to New York and open tonight at the celebrated Off-Broadway New York Theater Workshop, but there will not be an opening night. In late February, the theater announced it was indefinitely postponing production of the play due to the current political climate. The theater's artistic director, James Nicola, told The Guardian of London, quote, "In our pre-production planning and our talking around and listening in our communities in New York, what we heard was that after Ariel Sharon's illness and the election of Hamas, we had a very edgy situation." Nicola went on to say, quote, "We found that our plan to present a work of art would be seen as us taking a stand in a political conflict that we didn't want to take." But the theater has been accused of political censorship. The co-creator of the play, Alan Rickman, responded by saying, quote, "This is censorship born out of fear," and that the theater had effectively canceled the play. Today, in a Democracy Now! Broadcast exclusive, we host a discussion between one of the creators of the play, My Name is Rachel Corrie, and the New York Theater Group that postponed the production of the play. In London, we're joined by Catherine Viner. She's the co-editor and co-producer of My Name is Rachel Corrie. She's editor at The Guardian newspaper in London. Here in our New York studio, we're joined by James Nicola. He is the artistic director at the New York Theater Workshop, as well as the theater's managing director, Lynn Moffitt. And we welcome you all to Democracy Now! Well, why don't we begin with you, Jim Nicola, about this play, about My Name is Rachel Corrie, about its plans for production, opening night tonight, and why it was canceled or indefinitely postponed.
Sure. Well, I would want to go back a little bit to, excuse me, my original reading of the play, which was inspiring and moving, and I really connected to what Catherine Viner and Alan Rickman were trying to do in their portrait, which in any artist who's approaching a character or a subject shapes the material into something. And they said, as in Catherine said, what did she want people to feel or think about when they walked out of the play? She said, to feel inspired, to go out and do something about the world's inequalities. And I thought that was an excellent thing to put forward in New York. All of us Americans, myself included, live in some sort of fog of avoidance and denial. And here was a beautiful example of someone who pierced through that and did something and made a commitment. I also thought a lot about my nieces and nephews who are roughly her age now, and I see how they're living, and I thought she would be a wonderful example to them, to all of us. But this portrait that they wanted to create was about, they had a very particular view, which I really supported and believed in, which is the example she set with her life. And they wanted to keep at bay, for the sake of this argument and this portrait, anybody who would walk in with any particular idea or bias or view and say, just for the sake of this argument, look at this beautiful act of commitment and courage and idealism. And let's hold our thoughts and just study that example. And that was what we were trying to fight for. And as on this very short time frame that we had to mount this, we didn't realize at the beginning the complexity of that task.
Well, before we talk about the controversy over the staging of this and what happened, let's turn to Catherine Viner, co-editor and co-producer of My Name is Rachel Corrie, and start at the beginning. Tell us about this play, how you came to edit it, and why we call you co-editor as opposed to playwright.
Right. Well, it all began just after Rachel was killed. Her family released lots of her emails home from Gaza, and they were published around the world, including in The Guardian, which is the newspaper I work for in London. And they were astounding. They were so powerful and evocative and moving. And Alan Rickman, the Hollywood actor, he saw them and got very excited and took them to the Royal Court Theatre and said, "These should make a play. These are fantastic." And I was asked to get involved at that point. And we approached Rachel's family to ask for permission. And obviously, it was a very hard time for them. And they said, "You know, we love theatre, but you know, give us some time. We need to think about this." And then I think it was about a year later they came back to us. And in that meantime, we'd been really thinking about how we could do this. We were thinking of doing a patchwork of voices from Rachel's friends in Olympia, Washington, which is where she was from, her friends in Gaza, fellow activists, Israeli soldiers. We were imagining sort of creating a whole patchwork of a play. But then suddenly there landed on our doorstep 184 pages of Rachel's words. And her family had gone and discovered all these journals that she'd left behind in her bedroom. And they had typed them up for us, which was a real emotional task, as you can imagine. And they were her journals from the age of 10. And you can imagine, we were so excited about this. And we realized that we didn't need to be playwrights. We just needed to edit Rachel's words, that Rachel could tell her story all on her own. And so then the patchwork was just moving around Rachel's words, timings. And in fact, the first third of the play is before she even goes to Gaza. And it's her packing in her bedroom, finding old journals, telling stories about bumping into ex-boyfriends or her job or female friends or just being an ordinary teenager before she made the big decision to go to Gaza.
And so you staged this at the Royal Court Theatre in London?
That's right. Yeah. Now, we staged it in April last year. And in fact, it was sort of this huge success immediately. We were very shocked because obviously it was a small play about, you know, in a political play. I mean, there is a trend for political theatre in London at the moment, but we hadn't realised quite how successful it would be. And in fact, the Royal Court said it was their fastest sellout in their 50-year history. And this is the theatre Look Back in Anger. And it was their biggest sellout in their 50-year history, which was fantastic. And there were lines of people waiting outside the theatre every night for returns. So we quickly brought it back to a larger theatre also at the Royal Court, which was also a sellout. And next week, in fact, when the New York transfer was cancelled, a West End producer stepped in, and now the play is transferring to the West End next week. The West End is the equivalent of Broadway. So we're hoping it's going to be a major commercial success as well as a major artistic success.
So now let's go to what happened in New York. The play was presented to the New York Theater Workshop. You read it, Jim. You loved it. You said, let's go with it. And the schedule was set. Then what happened?
Well, we started onto our usual process of how do you make the pathway for a writer's voice, you know, publicly. From it goes from the page to the stage, and then you have to bring people to it. And I took very seriously this desire of Catherine Viner and Alan Rickman to find this place where people could be, feel safe and free to suspend their points of view, to listen to Rachel and to look at Rachel in this particular way. And then certainly I am more educated now on this whole conflict than I was at the start of it. And in fact, I look back 6-8 weeks and I feel like I'm a different person. But as we started to learn and listen, that task just seemed to get bigger and more complicated, in addition to other production logistical questions because of the short time frame. We're also growing concerns. So and maybe Lynn, you might want to talk a little about that.
Well, before Lynn, you speak, we're going to go to break, and then we'll come back to this discussion. We're talking about the controversy over the play My Name is Rachel Corrie that was supposed to open in New York tonight. Our guests are Jim Nicola and Lynn Moffitt. They are the two directors of the New York Theater Workshop. And in London, we're joined by Catherine Viner, the co-editor and co-producer of the play that is now in London. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
Sometimes I hear a voice calling me, and I don't know where it comes from. Maybe it's her voice that I have lost, the voice of my beloved who's gone. Maybe it's the sound of the blowing wind, and I imagine that she. I can't hear your voice. From time to time,
Shab Abed singing Someone Following Me. It's a song written for Rachel Corrie. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR and low power FM and college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375 on our video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org, and you can get our transcripts there as well. There's a letter today in the New York Times. It's written by Harold Pinter, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, Gillian Slovo, Stephen Fry, and it's dated March 20th. The letter was signed by 18 others, and it says, "We are Jewish writers who have supported the Royal Court production of My Name is Rachel Corrie. We're dismayed by the decision of the New York Theater Workshop to cancel or postpone the play's production. We believe that this is an important play, particularly perhaps for an American audience that too rarely has an opportunity to see and judge for itself the material it contends with. In London, it played to sellout houses. Critics praised it. Audiences found it intensively moving. So what is it about Rachel Corrie's writings, her thoughts, her feelings, her confusions, her idealism, her courage, her search for meaning in life? What is it that New York audiences must be protected from?" The letter goes on to say, "The various reasons given by the workshop, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's coma, the election of Hamas, the circumstances of Rachel Corrie's death, the, quote, symbolism of her tale, make no sense in the context of this play and the crucial issues it raises about Israeli military activity in the occupied territories." And the final line of the letter says, Rachel Corrie gave her life standing up against injustice. A theater with such a fine history should have had the courage to give New York theatergoers the chance to experience her story for themselves." Signed, Gillian Slovo, Harold Pinter, Stephen Fry. London, March 20th, 2006. Harold Pinter this year won the Pulitzer Prize. Our guests, Lynn Moffitt, Managing Director, won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Lynn Moffitt is Managing Director of the New York Theater Workshop in our studio with Jim Nicola, Artistic Director, and in the London studio, Catherine Viner, co-editor and co-producer of My Name is Rachel Corey. Lynn Moffitt, your response to the letter.
To the letter? It's a beautiful letter. It actually addresses the issues that we were concerned about. We believe in Rachel's voice, as they believe in Rachel's voice. We want it heard by a New York audience, but we want the voice heard by the New York audience, not the ancillary events that can pollute that voice. So that is the purpose of the methodology that New York Theatre Workshop employs when it uses when it develops context for a play. I know context has become a much maligned word in the last few weeks, but that is what we do. Because ultimately, the purpose of the workshop in producing art is to foster community dialogue. And to do that requires a lot of work just beyond the play that is seen on stage.
But now, you did agree to produce the play, and it was going to have its opening night tonight.
And we still want to produce the play.
Yep.
We still want to produce the play. And the word indefinite, we don't know where that word came from. We never canceled the play. We were having a conversation with our colleagues at the Royal Court about the difficulties that we were having, not only just with the research that we were doing about the project and about the play, but also about, you know, contracts and budgets and fundraising and all that sort of stuff.
Visas.
We were having a conversation with them, and then Catherine's letter appeared in The Guardian.
Catherine Viner, your response.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm actually not a co-producer of the play. I was just the co-editor. So, but as I understand it, we had everything set. Our flight tickets were booked. I was due to fly out yesterday to New York. The production schedule was finalized. Both sides of the Atlantic had agreed on a press release that was going to go out to the press announcing the production of My Name is Rachel Corey. And then the Royal Court, as I'm told, received a telephone call saying that the play was to be postponed indefinitely. That's where the phrase came from. We said we regarded that as a cancellation because everything was ready and there were barely, I think it was 5 or 6 weeks to go. And then they asked us, New York Theatre Workshop asked the Royal Court to give them time in order to work out how to present this postponement, as they called it, cancellation, as we took it to be. And we gave them that time, but then Mr. Nicola started talking and saying that it was a tentative arrangement. He started giving quotes saying that it was actually a tentative arrangement. And we felt at that point we had to go public with the story because it was not a tentative arrangement. This was a definite arrangement. But, you know, I think we could get into the, you know, you emailed on this day, you telephoned on this day conversation. But actually, there's a much bigger picture here and a much more important story, which is about the political smearing of Rachel Corrie. And there's no doubt that the New York Theatre Workshop was the victim of a political smear campaign. And I could have, you know, I understand this about contextualization. I personally think that works of art should be able to stand on their own and consultation isn't necessary. However, if that's how things are done in New York, then I understand why, you know, say Jewish community groups may have been contacted. I don't quite understand why Arab American groups weren't contacted. And I also don't understand why I wasn't consulted. You know, I was brought in to do this play because I understood the political context and I know about narrative, but also mainly because I understand about the political context. And I could have warned the New York Theatre Workshop all about the misinformation there is about Rachel Corrie on the internet. I could have told them why. I understand why that happens. She's a very powerful figure. And I could have helped them.
Your response?
Well, it's deeply regrettable. I would have loved to have been consulting with Catherine. It would have been immensely helpful. But in the time frame that we were on, I had various phone calls with Diane Borger at the Royal Court, two visits from Alan Rickman, and we were underway, and I felt we should consult with most of the people around that table, myself, Alan, were of a similar mind about issues, and it seemed the logical next step would be to speak to people who might have a different point of view. And that's when we went, and we did a lot of internet research. We saw all of what Kathleen mentions about this terrible misinformation out there, which made me only more certain that we had to have very strong plans to neutralize that or make it go away or answer a question when it was posed.
And what do you mean by contextualization? You'd present the play, and then what?
Well, we were discussing the idea of, after every performance, giving the audience an opportunity to discuss what they had just experienced.
In a very structured format.
Right.
We don't just have post-performance discussions where, you know, audience members just simply react to the play. We actually were talking about bringing in scholars, bringing in various voices from the communities, and having very structured discussions that would not that would help people understand the complexities of the situation. Rachel's voice is very clear. There is no question about that, but it sits in a larger world.
And that larger world is?
That larger world is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. There's no question about that.
Catherine Viner.
It's almost as if you're suggesting that people need to, you know, read a full history of Israel from 1948 to the present day before they're even allowed to see this play. It's a work of art that can stand on its own. And, can I ask you who you consulted before cancelling the play?
It was a lot of different people from that were colleagues and colleagues of colleagues who we consulted. But I do want to say that the Royal Court did an absolutely brilliant job of contextualizing the play, including giving that history from 1948 of the conflict through its Young Writers Program. We were at the workshop very impressed with the work that our colleagues at the Royal Court had done.
Thank you very much.
On that question of who you consulted, The Nation magazine's cover story is about tickets too hot to handle. And it talks about a PR firm, a consulting firm, Finn Reuter, saying that they were involved in advising you against this play. Is this true?
We use a lot of consultants. I mean, not-for-profits have to because we don't have the money to keep, you know, such expertise on staff. I mean, it includes legal, accounting, advertising, marketing, press, PR. There's a lot that we need these people. We rely on these people. In the case of Reuter Finn, we have been working with Reuter Finn for over 10 years, and we are working with them on a project, but it is not related to the play.
And what is that project?
Essentially, we're working on a long-range plan, strategic plan for the workshop, and that's what we're talking to them about.
In this article on The Nation, they contend that Reuter Finn said they would not represent you if you went ahead with this play.
That's not true.
And they also say that Reuter Finn was involved with representing the State of Israel in the past.
I don't know about, but I would say that I would just say that it was a mischaracterization.
So they would continue to represent you if you went ahead with this play?
I believe so.
Were they polling community groups or were they, quote, term has been used, auditing, getting a sense of the community for you of how people would respond?
No, they were not. No Jewish groups were polled. That was a word that came from the New York Times, and that got picked up around the world as well. I mean, certain words got picked up and censorship, indefinite polling. These are words that have that we're sorry got picked up and that were essentially were never questioned and just repeated over and over again.
Since you had agreed to go ahead with the play and it was going to open tonight, at what point did you change? What was the, not particularly the date, but the reason where you said we're pulling it for now?
There were several. And Jim came to his conclusion, and I came to my conclusion that we needed to ask for a postponement. We needed more time for different reasons. It wasn't simply the contextualization. I was also very, very concerned as the managing director about the business deal. It hadn't been completed. And that is a, I mean, you
but
know,
you were,
yes.
But it, the tickets were up on telecharge and you were moving forward tonight.
Well,
but,
you know, that's sort of just, you know, that's sort of theater business. You can put tickets up on, they weren't on sale. The computer program had been built. Drafts were going. We were trying to get a lot of work accomplished in a very short period of time. So I had all the, I didn't go A, B, C, D. I just said, everybody, just do your jobs and let's try to get this done. We really moved forward with the best intent.
Did the mayor's office weigh in, Mayor Bloomberg of New York City? Was there any involvement?
No.
No discussions with his office? That was something that was also raised in the Nation piece?
No, none.
In his Office of Cultural Affairs?
No.
Not that I'm aware of.
Has this happened to you before, where you set a play, you set a schedule, you say what the opening night is, the tickets say they're going to go out, the telecharge says they've got the tickets, and then it's pulled?
I would say, pulled is a rough word, but I would say that 50% of the productions that we schedule do not happen in the schedule that we had originally intended. That's a lot. That's
with
half.
6 weeks' notice, Lynn?
With 6 weeks' notice. Catherine, you have to remember, you know, Rachel Corrie wasn't coming into an empty spot in the theater. There had been another artist booked there, and we had come to an agreement with him to
move his
show next season so we could do Rachel Corrie.
If this was just about theatrical logistics, why then, in your first interview, did you say it was because of the election of Hamas in the Palestinian elections and Ariel Sharon's ill health?
I regret that I was naive in talking to the press at that point. It was a part of something, and there was a much bigger picture, and that was sort of pulled out. So I have to take some responsibility for being an imprecise
But at a
speaker.
Time, you were concerned about these political developments.
I was concerned about how do we keep focused on this thing that we all agree is the center, this idealistic, inspiring example.
Now, of course, the Middle East is admired in controversy and has been for many, many years. Why is this different right now?
I think we weren't cognizant of how Rachel was being viewed on all sides of the spectrum, and that is something that we were learning as we went through this process.
What is it that you heard about Rachel Corrie that was a different picture than you had? Than was presented in the play with just her own words.
Well, I can speak to one very terrifying, I guess, conversation I had with a very good friend who is Jewish, and certainly every conversation I've ever had with him about Israel, he's been extremely critical of policy and action. And I gave him this play, and he read it, and he had real problems with it. And I was really surprised to hear it from him. And I was really surprised because I had such a love for this play and this young woman that it hurt me that there would be a question of it. And he said to me, did you know she was a member of Hamas? And I didn't know what that, I hadn't heard that, and it seemed to be true to me. And I said, no. And he said, well, it's on the internet that she was. And in that moment, I realized, well, there's a lot, because in my position, I have to try and prevent that from taking hold. I have to be able to answer that question. And then as we went onto the internet, there was much more that, you know,
I saw it on the internet.
I thought the Mother Jones article was particularly intriguing because the author of that article lays out a lot of different perspectives.
Newsweek reporter Joshua Hammer.
Yes, it was really fascinating.
Catherine
But these
Viner.
Are all part of a. This is all part of a really big smear campaign against Rachel Corrie and
yes.
against many, as happens with many activists. And I can sort of see why. You know, she was the first American citizen, perhaps the only American citizen, I don't know, but to be killed by the Israeli army. She wrote so powerfully and so brilliantly about life under occupation, which is terrifying to mm-hmm. hear if it's not something you hear very often. But also, you know, she's young, beautiful, blonde, white, American. She's completely easy to relate to, and for a vast majority of Americans, and that makes her very dangerous. And that's why there's been so much misinformation about her on the internet and elsewhere. But again, I would have loved to have helped you with that. I knew about all of that. I'm one of the people who's read every single word that Rachel wrote, and I've read a huge amount of what's been written about her, and I can see the gap between the two. And surely one has to go for the truth rather than these kind of myths that surround people who are dangerous.
Right. Well,
absolutely.
Jim, let me ask something. So this one conversation with a friend who alleged that Rachel was a member of Hamas turned this whole play around and led to the postponement of it?
No, it was the beginning of the dawning of the scale of this task in the sense of 4 weeks before a proposed first performance that I had a lot of learning to do. We had a lot of planning and plotting and strategizing to do to make this happen.
Did you also consult with members of the Palestinian community in New York or the Arab American community?
We did not at that point, because we were at the beginning of this. We certainly would have, and we were certainly looking on the internet. And frankly, because we were at the beginning of this, as I said earlier, the people that were sitting around the table in this conversation were of a particular mind. We were of a similar point of view.
I'd also like to point out, though, sitting around that table were Americans and British, and Rachel's voice, which is, as you said, Catherine, American. We had no Palestinian voices yet, and that was one of the reasons we needed more time, was because we needed to explore all of the voices that were coming out of that community, and that takes time.
Now, the play is only her words.
Yes.
Only her words. It is a beautifully crafted piece of theater.
So where do you go from here? Are you sorry you put this off?
No, I'm not sorry. I think we did the responsible thing. We did the responsible thing for the play.
And, you know, I would still love to see it happen. I would really love to see it happen. I so believe in this voice and the importance of this voice being heard now. Here.
Tony Kushner also condemned the postponement mm-hmm. of the play, whose play you had produced on Afghanistan, on
mm-hmm.
Kabul.
Right.
Your response to that?
Well, I think, you know, everyone's should have a point of view, and I'm glad in a certain way that he has taken that stand, because I think it starts to provoke an important dialogue in our community about how do we talk about difficult, complicated issues and ideas. And I hope this is leading to that kind of conversation.
I wanted to play a clip of Vanessa Redgrave. We were in London, and we spoke to her. And Vanessa Redgrave, of course, was involved in supporting the Royal mm-hmm. Court Theater production. And this is what she had to say.
Essence of life and the essence of theater is to communicate about lives, either lives that had ended or lives that are still alive, beliefs, what is in those beliefs. And this was an extraordinary young girl. It wasn't, she didn't take sides, although she went to defend Palestinians. It isn't about taking sides, it's about defending human life. That's the basis of all human rights. That's the basis of what every country proclaims it stands for. I don't know of a single government that actually abides by international human rights law. Not one, including my own, in fact, violate these laws in the most despicable and obscene way, I would say. But to cancel a play, and it wasn't really a play, to cancel a voice, because it was her voice, is an act of such catastrophic cowardice, because we're living in times when people are quite fearful enough about speaking out for losing their career or, you know, whatever. And I think it's people in the theatre and film, radio, television, dance, music. We have to do what we must do.
Vanessa Redgrave speaking at her home in London. Your response, Jim Nicola?
I would just repeat, we did not cancel the play. We asked for more time to do our job as we understood it, to make this voice ring out loud and clear. And I think that's, you know, at some point everyone has to make a personal decision about when they're going to fight a battle, when they're going to take it on, how they're going to take it on. Are they fully prepared to fight that battle?
Do you have a date set for when you've offered the Royal Court Theatre to...
We do not... We have not had any communication with the Royal Court, so there's no... And we do not have the rights. They have the rights.
And are you offering them that you would...
Yes.
We have offered that.
And
yes.
When is your proposal for doing it?
They have the rights. That would be a conversation that they would now have to come back to us and have that conversation.
The problem with this is that we have artists who are of, you know, high quality with huge, busy lives, and finding time when the theater is free and when they're free.
Would you say it would be within this year?
We would like
sure.
to.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you now are making the offer you would do it at any point from now on?
We have other commitments, but we have empty slots.
And that's basically the conversation we were having with the Royal Court. Can we move this to a time that gives us a little more room to do all of the work that has to get done? And can we find a time that is good for Alan, that is good for Megan Dodds, the actress?
And if the politics changed in the Middle East, would that affect your schedule?
No.
Although...
Amy, if I could come in here, Amy.
Catherine Viner.
Yeah, I'm afraid to say, I think that there's just been such a breakdown of trust with what's happened that I don't think that the Royal Court, and I certainly don't think Rachel's family, would be keen on the play coming to the New York Theatre Workshop. However, the theatre has been inundated with requests from other theatres throughout America and many theatres in New York. And we really do hope we will come to New York this year.
Have you been inundated with response? Is this the biggest response you have gotten to anything you've ever done, is canceling or postponing this play?
We had a huge response when we proceeded with Tony Kushner's Somebody Cobble right after 9/11.
And now he's condemned your decision not to do that.
Well, I'm not sure that I would characterize it as condemned. I mean, Tony is a brilliant man, and he speaks... He hasn't simply condemned the decision. We've had several conversations with Tony. One of the reasons we were able to proceed with Homebody Cobble after 9/11 was because we had done an extraordinary amount of research prior to 9/11, so that when the world changed,
we
were able to proceed. But we had about 6 months prior to 9/11.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We'll find out what Rachel's parents think, because they'll join us in our next segment. We'll be joined by Cindy and Craig Corey. I want to thank you both for being with us, Jim Nicola and Len Moffitt of the New York Theater Workshop, and Catherine Viner, who is the co-editor of My Name is Rachel Corey, speaking to us from London, where the play is now showing. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back with Rachel's parents in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined in our studio by Rachel Corrie's parents, Craig and Cindy Corrie. They've traveled to New York to attend a public reading of Rachel's writings tonight at Riverside Church. It was supposed to have been the opening night of the play My Name is Rachel Corrie at the New York Theater Workshop, as we just discussed. Last year, the Corries initiated lawsuits against the State of Israel, the Israel Defense Forces, and Caterpillar, the manufacturer of the Israeli military bulldozer that crushed Rachel to death on March 16, 2003, just a few days before the invasion of Iraq. We welcome you both to Democracy
Now! Thank you.
Well, you've been listening to the discussion. Your response, would you be willing for the New York Theater Workshop to move ahead with the play based on Rachel's writings?
We really defer to the Royal Court Theater in deciding what the next step should be with the play. It's actually going to be playing in the West End in London again, starting at the end of this month. I think Catherine, when she talked about the breakdown of trust, I think that's a real concern. We know that the original intentions of the New York Theater Workshop were good intentions. They wanted to bring the play here, and we respect that. And we certainly have, you know, we don't wish any ill towards them or towards any of their staff around this. But I think I have some real concerns about the amount of contextualizing and so forth that they wanted to do. Mr. Nicola spoke about wanting to sort of set the stage to get Rachel's voice out there. And I would just say, in London, that happened just by presenting the play, by allowing people to come to see it. And I would say, let Rachel do that. Let her get her words out. And
you saw the play in London. Did you speak to people who watched it?
We did once, and then afterwards. But most people don't really want to talk coming out of the play. It's very quiet at the end of the play. And people came for a variety of reasons. My daughter Sarah and I sat next to a woman who came from a very small town in northern England. She just came because she loved Alan Rickman and wanted to see what he put on. Had no idea what she was going to see. Cindy spoke to a couple that came from Israel and saw that My Name is Rachel Corrie was the pick of the week. So they decided they had to see it. They told Cindy that they were members of the Likud party, a very conservative party in Israel, but they loved the play because it was not against Israel, but it was against violence. I listened today and I hear these people talking about trying to put a context in advance around this play. And it sounds like they're apologizing for the play. Why would you apologize for a piece of art in which you believed in? You would just present it. That's all they have to do is let Rachel speak for herself. And I'm very sorry, but it seems like now that we have this cacophony of sound around Rachel's words of what side is it on? This is a play really about my daughter. It's about from when she was 10 years old and until she died. It's through her words and a little bit of Cindy and me and somebody else. To me, they should just let those words come out. Let our daughter talk for herself.
And what they were what Jim Nicola raised when he was speaking with someone who said, "Did you know that Rachel was a member of Hamas?" Your response?
Well, just outrageous, untrue things. And if you go to the internet and Google, you will see outrageous, untrue things. I mean, Rachel went there with the International Solidarity Movement, which is a Palestinian-led, nonviolent resistance movement, direct action resistance movement. Two things that it calls for are believing in the rights of the Palestinian people to freedom and to use only nonviolent direct action means of resistance. There are outrageous things on the internet about many people, but to make a decision based on, you know, what should happen to this piece of art, this play, based on those kinds of things is very troubling to me, more troubling than I thought it would be.
I guess I would urge Ms. Nicola to go to the U.S. State Department's website, and on there you can find the human rights reports for the last 3 years. There, Rachel is listed as a human rights observer. Her killing, of course, is a human rights violation, and is listed in their report, but under an observer of human rights. And that's how our State Department and our government looks at Rachel.
Your description of what happened to her, this is just past the third anniversary of her death, March 16th, 2003, 3 days before the invasion of Iraq. If you could bear to tell us.
You mean what happened to Rachel? On March 16th, 2003, Rachel was with seven other members of the International Solidarity Movement from the United States and from the UK. They had been working in front of a home, one of the homes that was threatened with demolition because of where it was located on this border strip that was being cleared. Bulldozers were working in the area, two bulldozers, each with two operators aboard and an APC vehicle. They would come up to the activist and stop at their feet and then retreat. They went back to the border at one point, and the activists thought they had been successful in stopping a demolition that day. But then they returned, and after they came back, within 5 minutes, Rachel was killed. A bulldozer, she took a stand in front of the Nasrallah house. She knew that there was a family with five young children behind the walls of that house. And a bulldozer proceeded. She took a stand, raised her arm, showed that she wasn't moving. The bulldozer came forward, continued over her, and according to the ISM reports, even though they were screaming and yelling, the bulldozer stopped and then backed over her again. And that's what the photographs also show happened.
Amy, I'd just like to point out something, because we've talked about what's out on the internet, and sometimes this family is referred to as terrorists that Rachel was protecting, and members of that family actually were on your show, and that was beaming from Des Moines, Iowa, where they were. So a 34-year-old man and his wife and their small baby that wasn't born when Rachel was killed came to the United States. To do that, they had to go to Tel Aviv to get a visa. So they got a visa from the Israeli government to go walk the streets of Tel Aviv. They got a visa from the United States to walk in Des Moines, Iowa. And neither one of those countries had anything against this family whose home they destroyed and lives they threatened. And that, to me, is telling a story that we don't hear in the United States. And I think it changes everything. Rachel was standing in front of a home, protecting the home and the lives of a family for whom Israel had nothing against them besides their home was where they wanted to destroy it.
Well, certainly this controversy has launched events all over the world of the reading of Rachel's words, and people can go to their website at rachelwords.org to see all of these events. You're here for tonight's event at Riverside Church.
Right. There's been a wonderful response from people who just believe that Rachel's voice should be heard, and a group of those people are here in New York City, and there will be this event at 8 o'clock tonight at Riverside Church. There are a wonderful group of performers and readers that are going to be there. We're going to be there, and we're very excited about this and very heartened by the response from all over the world. This has been true really since Rachel was killed, that we hear from people all over, but this is a particularly exciting event.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Cindy and Craig Corey, parents of Rachel, as we wrap up today's broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org. Our producers, Mike Berkshire, Fovdokadoosh, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate, Mike DeFilippo, Danielle Peshkin, and Megan Whitney. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining.